I'm quite excited to be this talk because in fact I will be presenting some new stuff which is not yet written up. And okay, that's a danger that is completely wrong, and that you will find out why it is wrong. So this is going to be a challenge for me. So I'm
going to can you turn the microphone on?
Okay.
Okay, can you hear me?
Yes.
On Zoom as well?
Yes.
Good, thanks, Lee. So I was just saying that this is the outline of my talk, and I'm very keen to get to this section because here I will present new stuff, things that are not yet written up, things which are very speculative, and you may find fatal problems in what I have to present. But at least what I present here and here, this is going to be robust, even if the messages which I present are sort of controversial. Okay, so let me start with the introduction. And I will have two main messages in the introduction. Message one is that inflation is not the only viable early universe model. And then there'll also be a second message. Okay, so great. Now, when I say viable, what do I mean by viable? It should be a model that produces a roughly homogeneous an isotropic universe. It should be approximately spatially flat. And it should get a microwave background anisotropies. It should produce what we now have observed in terms of the spectrum of microwave anisotropies. So, okay. So let me sketch the data for microwave anisotropies. So you take the beautiful map of microwave anisotropies, you expand this map in spherical harmonics, large angular scales, small angular scales. This is the power. And the spectrum has the feature that it has these oscillations, and that there's a scale of the first peak, which is approximately 1 degree. So, okay, so it is these features which a viable early universe model should produce. Okay. Now, most of you are much younger than I am. And most of you have probably been told that this is a prediction of inflation. Is that correct? Have you heard that? Who has heard that? Okay, good. So this is now historically false because the physics that gives rise to these features was well understood 10 years before inflation, 1969-1970. By Zeldovich and Zunyayev. And by Peebles and Yu, independently. Okay, and if you look at the 1970 paper by Zeldovich and Zunyayev, you see the following space-time sketch. So space, my co-moving coordinates, this is time. This is the time of recombination when the microwave background is produced. And in their plot, they have a curve, which they call the gene's length, which before recombination is approximately equal to the Hubble radius. And the gene's length comes crashing down at recombination. And the gene's length, that's the length scale that divides scales on which fluctuations are frozen in from scales where fluctuations oscillate. So you have a fluctuation mode. So this purple line is the wavelength of a particular fluctuation. This is another one. And these fluctuations are standing waves until they enter the Hubble radius, then they start to oscillate. Okay, so good. So Zeldovich and Zuniaev people said you assumed that in the early universe there were standing wave fluctuations on all scales with an approximately scale invariant spectrum, because already in 1970 it was known that an approximately scale invariant spectrum is good to describe the galaxy distribution. So let's follow this standing wave. This standing wave enters the Hubble radius right at recombination. So when the microwave background is released, we catch this wave at maximal amplitude. This wave has done a quarter of an oscillation. We catch it at vanishing amplitude, maximal velocity. So you see, this is this scale. And this is this scale here. So the physics that gives rise to these acoustic oscillations in a microwave background were well understood 10 years before inflation.
Robert?
Lee, go ahead.
Yes, my vague memory is that when Alan Guth first gave talks about inflation, the point was the killing off of the monopoles, not the CMB curve.
That's right. So you are asking why don't I list monopoles here? The monopole problem.
I'm saying historically, what Alan Guth understood.
That's right.
What he had done was the monopole problem.
That's right.
CMB spectrum.
That's right, because the CMB fluctuations were. No, we didn't know this structure back in 1980 when inflation came about. So you're right that this was not contained in Alan Guth's original paper. This was Chibisov and Mukhanov and then Starobinsky also in 1980. Okay. Now, you see, the one question which was not addressed in these early papers is what gives rise to these standing wave fluctuations, which look like that they are acausal from this point of view of standard Big Bang cosmology. So now I want to list criteria for successful early universe cosmology in order to explain homogeneity and isotropy and the CMB anisotropies. So the first criterion is that this scale here cannot be the horizon. Because if it is the horizon, then we have no causal mechanism for producing these fluctuations. So the horizon, and by horizon I mean forward light cone of a point on some initial Cauchy surface. So the horizon has to be much bigger than the Hubble radius. That's in order to have a chance of addressing this issue. Now, the second criterion is that the scales, which are observable today, they originate sub-Hubble in the early universe. Otherwise, we don't have causal processes that move matter around to create these kind of perturbations. And then finally, the mechanism also has to generate scaling bounds. So the scaling bounds are the fluctuations. So that essentially is a statement that the amplitude of fluctuations on different wavelengths is the same in terms of the quad variable. So these are the criteria for successful early universe cosmology. And now I will draw you three space-time diagrams that correspond to different possibilities of satisfying these criteria. So the first one is inflation. And in inflation, there's a time interval during which space expands exponentially. Time, and here I will draw a physical distance. And in this period, the universe is expanding exponentially, standard Big Bang expansion, radiation dominated, or something else. So finite period of exponential expansion. A of t cosmological scale factor goes as e to the th. So now let me first look at the horizon. So the horizon increases linearly in this early period. And then during the time period when space expands exponentially, the horizon expands exponentially as well. Whereas the Hubble radius, which is the inverse expansion rate, is constant in this phase. So this is the horizon. And this is the Hubble radius. And now let me look at scales, which, for example, this green curve up there, this top graph is co-moving coordinates, here it's physical coordinates. So in the standard Big Bang phase, the wavelengths of perturbations that we are interested in is larger than the Hubble radius, but because of this exponential expansion of space, as long as this period of exponential expansion is long enough, the length scale can originate inside the Hubble radius. Criterion 2 satisfied. Now, the scaling bounds for inflation comes from the fact that the energy density in this phase is constant. And so whatever mechanism you have that produces fluctuations, be it vacuum or thermal, doesn't matter. By translation invariance, it will produce fluctuations which have the same amplitude that generates scaling bounds. So the argument that there's scaling symmetry argument goes back to Bill Press, my de facto PhD advisor, back in 1980.
So you're using the information that colors there?
So the green just up there, the green stands for a particular, the wavelength of a particular perturbation. Mm-hmm. This is this wavelength of a particular perturbation. This is physical coordinate, physical distance, co-moving distance. The fluctuation, you see, fluctuations have constant wavelengths in co-moving coordinates.
Okay. And the curve lambda j, which is the gene length, what is it in your diagram there?
That's the Hubble radius.
Okay, that's this one. Okay.
Yeah.
Oh, it's not the.
Yeah, so I was inconsistent. Inconsistent in colors. Okay. Sorry about that. Good. Now, scenario two. Is a cosmological bounce. So here, there's a bounce point, t equals zero. There's a contracting phase, and I better be consistent at least. Yeah. Standard Big Bang expansion, contracting phase, wavelengths of a fluctuation mode. And that's what the Hubble radius does. So you need new physics that gives us the transition from contraction to expansion. For example, the Kuskokwim model. So this is the cosmology. And you see, time runs from minus infinity to plus infinity. The horizon is infinite. This is satisfied. Scales that we observe today start out sub-Hubble in the early universe. This is satisfied. And whether you get scale invariance or not, that depends on the particular, on the properties of the contracted universe. For example, if you have a matter-dominated phase of contraction, then initial vacuum perturbations become scale invariant. Or if you have ekperiotic contraction, then you can also get scale invariance. So this is a second scenario. And the third scenario, the scenario which will be relevant to the third part of my talk, this is the emergent scenario. So here, I'm going to draw what the assumption is about the scale factor, or the effective scale factor, as a function of time. There's an emergent phase, standard Big Bang-like expansion. That's the assumption. The space-time diagram that results is the following. Standard Big Bang expansion. The horizon is infinite because this emergent phase the way that I've drawn it, it goes down to t equals minus infinity. So the horizon is much bigger than the Hubble radius. Scales that we observe today, this is quasi-static phase, so wavelength's constant. So they emerge sub-Hubble. And it turns out that if the fluctuations in this phase are holographic, holography is a big word now in string theory, so I will show you that the fluctuations indeed are going to be holographic in matrix cosmology, then you get the scale invariance. Okay, so this is my first message. First message is that there are several scenarios of early universe cosmology, not just inflation. And so for quantum gravity phenomenologists, there is no need to force inflation into your theory. If something else emerges, that is good.
Yes. I think Zhao and I discussed that possibility a long time ago. And we said it arose from spin flow models, not. Do you remember, Zhao?
Sure.
John McGuire.
Yeah. So again, so I don't, this is not an exclusive list of possibilities. For example, I'm not mentioning the variance speed of light scenario. The emphasis that I want to give here, the message is there's more than inflation. You don't need to embed. Maybe you find something better than these scenarios. And what I'm going to present is a realization of this emergent scenario. And I realize that Lee's done a lot of work on matrix cosmology in the past.
This emergent universe scenario that was proposed by George Ervis and Roy Martens quite some time
ago. No, it's different.
It's different, okay.
It does not have this evolution of the scale factor.
Oh, okay.
Yeah. And what do you mean when you say holographic?
By that I mean that the specific heat capacity,
yes, good,
goes as R square and not as R cubed in a volume R of side length R.
Great, good, good.
Good. So this was my first message. And my second message is that very generically, gravitational waves with a large amplitude are generated. I go to all these talks by observational cosmologists and to people working on CMB, new CMB missions, new large-scale structural missions, and I always say, we need to go after the B-mode polarization of a microwave background because that's the smoking gun of inflation. Sorry, folks. Very generically, you'll get large amplitude gravitational waves, and concretely, the statement is the following. In any theory in which you generate the cosmological perturbations as adiabatic perturbations, that's the usual way, you will generate, and you generate a scaling band spectrum of density perturbations, you will generate a scaling band spectrum of gravitational waves, typically with a larger amplitude than you get in inflation. So going after the B-mode polarization of the microwave background is very important, but not because you want to verify inflation, but because you want to roll it out. So that's the second message. And I think I should be a little bit more concrete here. I should give some equations.
I just want to say, I think that's the scenario dependent statement, Robert.
I will show you the equations on which I'm basing this on, and then you can object if I'm saying something wrong. So if I look at the curvature perturbations, and gravitational waves, I'm going to present you equations for the curvature perturbations and the gravitational waves. And let me write the metric in conformal time. So this is the metric of a cosmological background with scale factor A of tau, which includes curvature perturbations, phi of x t, and gravitational waves. This is the transverse traces gravitational wave tensor, so h I j of x and t. Now, there's matter that sources the curvature perturbations, for example, a scalar field. And I can define the canonical variable for curvature perturbations prime is derivative with respect to conformal time, and I can define the variable u, which is the rescaled amplitude of the gravitational wave. So this small h is the amplitude of one of the polarization modes of the HIJ tensor. So this is a variable that describes the curvature perturbations. This is a variable that describes the gravitational waves. Okay, so now it turns out that the equation of motion for V is the following. For the kth Fourier mode, and equation of motion for u is this. And for adiabatic perturbations, with a time-independent equation of state, you have Z proportional to A, and hence the equations are the same, and hence you will generate this the same spectrum of gravitational waves and curvature perturbations. All I'm using here is adiabatic perturbations. Perturbations start out with same initial conditions, get the same result.
You said what Z was in your notation?
Yeah, Z is, I didn't say it. Z is A times phi naught over H. Let me, I have to check if I get this right. Yeah, I think it's right. So, okay.
Oh, I was just saying that the sense in which it's scenario dependent is that there's, you know, a thing that Neil and I have been interested in is that there's two different ways to conformally couple a scalar in four dimensions. There's the normal way with a two derivative action.
Yeah, so this is a
possibility with a four derivative action.
Right, so I'm talking about
the two derivative. Exactly. I agree in that case that this is right.
Yeah. Okay.
The interesting thing about the other scalar is that it violates a lot of the conditions that you're mentioning here, that it's it has a scale invariant spectrum already in space.
So you see, in particular, in bouncing cosmologies, if you produce scalar perturbation, if you reduce the curvature perturbations with the adiabatic mode, and in the emergent scenario, you will produce gravitational waves. Okay, so these were the two messages that I wanted to get across in the introduction. Okay, so now I will come to the second part of the talk, namely to breakdown of EFT. Okay, so what do I mean by effective field theory? So I have fields, matter fields, and the gravitational fields. One of these fields is phi. In a volume V, I expand it in Fourier modes, co-moving Fourier modes. And this variable satisfies a harmonic oscillator equation. So I want to stress that this is co-moving K. This obeys a harmonic oscillator equation. And so the way that one proceeds in effective field theory is one quantizes these modes like one quantizes harmonic oscillators. Now somewhere there is a red chalk. Now I will need a red chalk. Because red means you should be very careful about this. So you see, for a harmonic oscillator, you have ground state energy. Okay. And since you have an infinite number of harmonic oscillators, you get an infinite ground state energy. This is the cosmological constant problem. I'm going to try to persuade you that if we start with matrix theory, there is no cosmological constant problem. Cosmological constant problem is automatically solved. So therefore, I want to highlight this here. So what does one do? The Hilbert space of an effective field theory is a product Hilbert space of the Hilbert spaces for each, the harmonic oscillator Hilbert space for each of the K modes. So now there might be an infrared cutoff. So K has to be greater than sub K min. This is co-moving. But to avoid the ultraviolet catastrophe, you need an ultraviolet cutoff. And this is fixed K physical. And K physical is A inverse K co-moving. So in an expanding universe, when A is increasing, in order to maintain a fixed physical ultraviolet cutoff, you have to keep creating new modes, completely non-unitary. Okay, and so you see that if we do that, we have the vacuum energy. The vacuum energy is totally dominated by this ultraviolet cutoff. It's going to be of the order K max to the fourth. So this is what I mean by effective field theory. Good. So now, let me go back to this diagram, inflation. So now I will add in red this warning scale, which is the Planck length, which is the thing that will give me the physical cutoff. So effective field theory obviously breaks down and you see, if inflation lasts a long time, then all the scales that we observe today come from this zone of ignorance. And hence, as Jérôme Martin and myself discussed in 20 years ago, at least in models where inflation lasts quite long, a little bit longer than the minimal time scale it has to last, all of the fluctuations that we observe today come from the zone of ignorance. Hence, we cannot trust the calculations. So that was a trans-Planckian problem. And the trans-Planckian problem, well, let's put it in what happens here. Let's assume that the energy density at the bounds is lower than the Planck scale. It's a modest assumption. Fluctuations are completely free from this problem. What happens? Where do we have the third scenario? Third scenario, well, I wash it away. In the emergent scenario, the same thing. Insensitive to the trans-Planckian problem. So this trans-Planckian problem is a problem specifically for inflation, and alternatives are safe from it. Now, Bedroya and Waffa in 2019, they elevated this trans-Planckian problem into a principle called the trans-Planckian censorship conjecture. Trans-Planckian censorship conjecture. And their conjecture is that no effective theory consistent with quantum gravity can have this bad feature. So if you take at some initial time, you start with a Planck length, and you evolve to some later time. So you let the initial Planck length expand from initial time to some final time. You have to remain smaller than the Hubble scale at that time. So this is the mathematical formulation of the trans-Planckian censorship conjecture.
The trans-Planckian conjecture would be automatically satisfied within the cosmology and emergent.
Exactly. Okay. Exactly. So the only of these scenarios of early universe cosmology, the only one which is constrained by the trans-Planckian censorship conjecture is poor inflation. So, now this is quite a strong conjecture. And let me try to give you three justifications for this conjecture. One of them is unitarity. One of them is Penrose's cosmic censorship hypothesis. And the third is second law of thermodynamics. So I'm going to argue that if you don't satisfy the Trans-Planckian censorship conjecture, you will have a non-unitary theory which violates the second law of thermodynamics, and it is in contradiction with Penrose's cosmic censorship conjecture. So, justification number one, Penrose. So let's take the diagram of a black hole with charge smaller than the mass. Then the observer at infinity is insensitive to the bad stuff that happens at the singularity. But Einstein's equations allow solutions with charge greater than mass. And for those solutions, the poor observer at infinity will not be protected against the bad things that happen at the singularity. And this is bad. And so Penrose says that the observer outside the distant observer is shielded from the singularity by a horizon. That's Penrose's cosmic censorship hypothesis. Now let's take position space and let it go to momentum space. Let's replace the horizon by the Hubble radius. And the observer who is distant, I replace that by an observer who measures sub-Hubble modes. And you see, if I translate Penrose's cosmic censorship hypothesis from black hole physics to cosmology, then I precisely get the conclusion that an observer measuring super-Hubble stuff, wavelengths bigger than the Hubble radius, must be shielded from the Trans-Planckian modes. That's the thing that replaces the singularity by the Hubble radius, which is precisely the TCC. So that's one justification.
I don't understand the argument. So first of all, within black hole physics, we need the principle, because if we are within a quantum gravity framework, it is likely that the singularity will be resolved.
That's right.
And in that case, I don't see why we should have an horizon shielding the observer from that.
That's right. So
I don't understand the relation between singularity and the Trans-Planckian modes.
Okay, so I'm giving you sort of a justification, a way to understand why one could have come up with this Trans-Planckian censorship conjecture. Now, you see, this is for Penrose, this is not a criticism of quantum gravity, but it's a criticism of Einstein gravity as an effective field theory.
Yes.
It says that is Einstein gravity as an effective field theory has to break down. And it may break down in the way that you indicated. And in the same way, I'm saying that the effective field theory description of early universe cosmology will break down. Now, the reason why I'm replacing the horizon by the Hubble radius, this is a very conservative choice. So perturbations on sub-Hubble scales only oscillate. And so I don't care if trans-Planckian junk stays sub-Hubble and oscillates, but I don't want trans-Planckian stuff to become super-Hubble classicalized and become stuff that we measure. So it's a conservative choice to replace the black hole horizon by the Hubble horizon. Conservative choice. I would have stronger criteria if I would put in a different choice. Okay, now, since I'm running a little bit late on time, I just want to mention in words the justification number two. So this is unitarity. I already illustrated that you need to continuously create modes in an effective field theory description of inflation. And that means that you're violating unitarity. And if you want to keep the unitarity violation to scales which don't classicalize, then you get precisely the trans-Planckian transition conjecture. So this is the second, but it's a very strong justification. And justification number three, this is the second law of thermodynamics. So if you have accelerated expansion, for example, inflation, then the phase space of super Hubble modes grows, and therefore the entanglement entropy between super Hubble and sub Hubble stuff grows. And if you demand that the entanglement entropy density at the end of inflation remain smaller than the temperature after inflation, so after inflation we have thermodynamic entropy, and if the entanglement entropy built up over a long period of inflation were, if the entanglement entropy density built up over a long period of inflation were to become larger than this, then you'd be violating the second law of thermodynamics. Okay, so basically justification for the TCC is you want to be consistent with the second law of thermodynamics, you want non-unitarities to be hidden by the Hubble horizon, and you want to satisfy Penrose. Good. Now, I should also mention that this is not a criticism against inflation per se. All it means that if you want to get inflation as an early universe cosmology, we have to go beyond effective field theory. And there are ideas of obtaining inflation going beyond effective field theory, and I just want to mention Giad Valli and collaborators' work and the work done at McGill by my colleague Keshav Dasgupta and Helitz and Bernardo Shidobrahma. So there are ways to try to get inflation as coherent states built on Minkowski spacetime, which are safe from these problems, but this is not an effective field theory description. Okay, so we have to go beyond effective field theory if we really want to understand the early universe. And so let me now turn to this.
Can I ask a question just to make sure I understand the third argument here? Is the idea that the entanglement entropy is getting converted into the thermodynamic?
Yes.
Converted into the radiation entropy at the end of inflation? That's where you want it to be less?
So what I'm saying is that if the entanglement entropy at the end of inflation, if the entanglement entropy density is bigger than this, then you won't be able to get successful reheating. You won't be able, in order to get the standard Big Bang phase, you will have to violate thermodynamics.
And that's because you're imagining that the entanglement entropy has to go away at the end of inflation.
I'm saying that the total entropy cannot decrease. And the total entropy is thermal entropy plus entanglement entropy.
But Robert, does this mean you're assuming and not discovering that you have unitarity at late times? Because it's a condition you're imposing.
No, I'm sticking in. I'm sticking in unitarity.
You're so, adding it, yes. But what, you don't have a justification for that.
No, no, I don't have it. I'm very conservatively. I want the early universe theory to be unitary. I know that you're much more radical than me, so I'm taking a conservative point of view. Very conservative. And so therefore I'm going to start with a particular action. And I'm going to see what comes out from this particular action.
Okay.
Can you elaborate on what you mean by breakdown of EFT? The way I use it, I mean, breakdown of EFT means, you know, no more the breakdown of decoupling. I mean
that the description of the early universe using an effective field theory has fatal problems, and we need to go beyond that.
Can you elaborate a bit? In what way would that mean?
I really can't precisely elaborate on that. What I'm going to propose is a way to go, to start with a concrete action and to see what early universe cosmology comes out of it. So, but we can talk about that later. Okay.
If we have like primordial black holes and add that up, would that resolve the like add on the right hand side of stuff?
Yep. So you see, I'm talking, I'm doing a very simple setup where I have just a homogeneous and isotropic metric plus small perturbations. If you add black holes, then you have more severe constraints. So you could elaborate, you could build on this and include black holes, and then you would get more stricter constraints. That's a good point. Okay, so now, just to give you a feeling for where I'm going to start with an action. I'm going to start with a Lagrangian. And the Lagrangian has 9 matrices, which are Hermitian. And there's an action, which has the form 1/2. Then there's dxi square. Then there's a potential term. And they're also fermionic. Okay, so trace. Okay, so I have time, but there's no space. And this D is an operator, which is partial derivative minus I, A, this is a commutator. So you see there's a 10th matrix, another Hermitian matrix. So there's no space. And this is a quantum mechanical model, so there's no singularity. These are not harmonic oscillators, so there's no harmonic oscillator ground state energy. Now I'm going to take the limit where n goes to infinity, and I will take g square n to be fixed. That's a Toft constant, that's a limit that's been studied a lot. So this is my conservative starting point, and this is a starting point which was put forward by Banks, Fischler, Susskind, and Schenker in 1997. And this was proposed as a non-perturbative definition of superstring theory. So this is a starting point. So it's this Lagrangian.
Robert, you have a metric. You have a metric on space, tying up those indices I. So you have.
That's not, so. That, thanks for mentioning that. I have a eta mu nu symbol, which is used to actually to raise the indices. Thanks for pointing this out. And this is going to give me local Lorentz invariants of the resulting effective theory. So that's the starting point.
Excuse me? Because, I mean, there you have here a separation of the time and the space.
Yeah, that's right. So this 9 plus 1 split is put in by hand. So I don't explain the signature of what will the emergent space-time be. The one time and nines, it will turn out that I will get space from these xi's.
Matrices are TOEFL or not?
Excuse me, Lee?
They're TOEFL matrices. You have the condition that they're eigenvectors in a sense under the translation.
Wait for that. I'll come to that. So this is the Lagrangian I'm starting with. There's an action. And what I will do now is I will take a high temperature state.
Could I ask, how unique is the Lagrangian? Do you know, is it determined by some conditions, or is it a...
Okay, this was justified by comparing perturbative calculations in this theory with perturbative calculations in string theory. Now, you can ask why 9 dimensions here? Why 9 matrices? There should be some anomaly cancellation argument at the level of matrix theory that is unknown. And I'm unable to figure out. So.
But so this portable action is pretty much determined by comparison with string theory?
That's how it was proposed. And I will take this to be the concrete starting point.
There is an anomaly calculation coming. Let me just say that.
Good. So now I will take the high temperature state, and then...
What is the field content? So you said you have fermions, and then the main part of the Lagrangian, what does that describe?
So basically, they are just supersymmetric partner matrices. Mm-hmm. So... But, and in the effective theory, they will give me the matter.
And the xi, what do they describe?
Okay. Well, I want to get space from them.
Okay.
So I will take this high temperature state. And then in a high temperature state, what you can do is, I will expand these matrices in Matsubara frequencies. Like one does in thermal field theory. Omega. So in the high temperature limit, beta is the inverse temperature. In the high temperature limit, it is xi naught which dominates. And you see, this is now a matrix that has no time dependence. Time has disappeared. And I can rescale that by a temperature. Give me the AIs. And then the action that I get for this BFSS is equal to the action which I will write down. Plus order 1 over t. And now I will write down what this is. This s I k k t is minus 1 over G square trace 1/4 a view. Use the same. Plus fermions. And again, Lee, there's the metric, this eta mu nu symbol, which is used to raise and lower the indices. So, plus the fermionic partners. No space, no time, no metric, nothing. These are Hermitian matrices. Now, I will use the basis in which A naught is diagonal. Okay, so my A naught will be diagonal of, let's say, alpha minus n half to alpha n half. And these alpha n's, that would be emergent time. Okay, this is emergent time. Now, what you can show numerically is that 1 over n times the expectation value. So this is a matrix reaction. That's a measure. You can take these trace of the Tangle matrix square, and you find that this goes as a coefficient times n. Small number, but it goes linearly in n. From this, you find that the total time, so these become time, the total time grows as square root of n. And the time difference between these eigenvalues scales as 1 over square root of n.
The combinator of A0 is dt.
It's the value of these, or the expectation value, that is time. And so essentially the difference between this and this is the total time interval, and the total time interval scales the square root of n. So the time variable that emerges is time that runs from minus infinity to plus infinity, and it's continuous time. So you get continuous infinite time. Okay, so now, give me 5 more minutes.
Yes.
Because I still have to get the metric, and I still have to get space, and I still have to get the metric.
You can be flexible.
So I'm not finished yet. So now I look at emergent space. So I look at these AI, the spatial matrices, and they are not diagonal, but they have a particular feature. So if I take this spatial matrix and I put myself on a distance t down the diagonal, where t is this location, and I look at a subblock of the matrix, of size n sub c, and I call the resulting matrix AI tilde and c of t. So it is a sub matrix which is positioned at that time. It has block size n c. Okay, then, first of all, what is known from numerical work is that these AI, AB, the off-diagonal elements of this matrix, that these decrease as you go away from the diagonal. So these spatial matrices have expectation values which are centered along the diagonal. So this is called block diagonal feature, and also it has the So this sum over I, and it has a feature that AB, that this is about constant if A minus B is equal to n smaller than n sub c. So that's a critical size of the block below, above which the off-diagonal elements go to zero, and below which the off-diagonal elements are approximately constant. Okay, so now, good. You see, the A's are the zero modes of the X's in the Matsubara expansion. Okay. Remember when I wrote down the Matsubara?
Yeah, okay.
So, and it's rescaled by a quarter power of the temperature.
Mm-hmm. Okay.
Okay, so now what you can do is you can look at 1 over N times the trace of AI tilde NC square. And you can call the of T, and you can call this R of T. And this is what Nishimura and collaborators did. And what they observed is the following. You start out with all 9 RIs the same, and then you get a symmetry breaking. 3 become large, and 6 remain small. So you have dynamical symmetry breaking that the original SO9 symmetry of the matrix theory is broken to SO6 cross SO3. So only 3 of these dimensions become large emergent spaces. 6 remain small. So this is wonderful. We want 3 large spatial dimensions. This emerges dynamically. Now, from the point of view of matrix theory, this is a complete mystery. You can check using Gaussian expansion methods that it makes sense. Numerically, you can show that. But I know why this happens. And the reason that this happens is that the strings are coherent states of this matrix model. And the strings can only intersect and get rid of windings in 3 spatial dimensions. And this is the mechanism for the symmetry breaking.
Are these matrices, they're being chosen randomly with a probability distribution given by e to the minus this? E to the IKKT? Is that the idea? Or where are the matrices coming from?
You mean who determines which of these become large? This is random.
The matrix.
There are 3.
The AI are random matrices.
That's right. But
the distribution that they're drawn with is given by this, by e to the.
That's right. That's right.
And then when you do that, you work in the basis where the
yep.
A0 is diagonal, you find that the.
Then you find that.
The symmetry is broken along the diagonal.
Yep. Yep. Okay, so now what will happen? Is that we're going to make a proposal. And our proposal is that for n smaller than nc, and it is known that nc scales as square root of n, we know this analytically. So we are going to interpret n as co-moving coordinate. And I'm going to define the physical length as this expectation value without the 1 over n for the nth subblock, ai square N of T trace, obviously. This will be a physical distance. Okay, so this is reasonable to define this as physical distance. This is a co-moving coordinate. Now, the physical distance gives me the integral over the co-moving coordinates times the square root of the metric. These are co-moving coordinates. So basically, by taking the derivative dli dn, I get the metric, the ii component of the metric. So this is the emergent metric. Okay, and if I use this property, P star, I will find, using P star, I will find that the emergent metric GII of N and T, so this is obviously depends on N, this is a time-dependent amplitude times delta I. So you get a homogeneous and isotropic metric of the three large dimensions with a time-dependent scale factor. Okay, so let's see what we see. Homogeneity and isotropy. Spatially flat, infinite time, infinite space. And now we can go back to our thermal state and we can compute thermal fluctuations because we have the partition function. Partial derivative of the partition function gives us the density perturbations in the gravitational waves. And I spoke about this 4 months ago here. You get scaling band spectra of density perturbations and curvature perturbations. This is a quantum system. A of T does not have any behavior that looks like a cosmological constant. A of T will grow at late times, like in a radiation-dominated universe, and overall it's symmetric. Basically, no cosmological constant. So these are the speculative things. So the proposal here is that from this matrix theory cosmology, Lagrangian, very concrete Lagrangian, we get emergent space, emergent time, an emergent universe, which has three large dimensions. We get a spatially flat metric. And the amplitude of these fluctuations are given by the string scale divided by the Planck scale to the fourth power. So this is the summary. So sorry for going over time.
Okay, are there questions? First of all, students.
You said that the dynamical symmetry breaking from SO9 to SO6, SO3 is due to the fact that string.
What's been established is the following. You can make an assumption about the state of the system at late times. You can put in different symmetry breaking patterns, and then you can compute the free energy for different symmetry breaking patterns using the Gaussian expansion method. And if you do that, then you find that you get that this symmetry breaking pattern has the lowest free energy. So this is the way that this has been analytically justified by Nishimura and collaborators. and then they've numerically observed this. But I think that what I said about the strings as coherent state, that gives the physical reason for why this symmetry breaking happens.
Right, and I see. So they're doing a perturbative expansion about the Gaussian fixed point.
That's right. That's right. Okay. And they are looking at different Gaussian fixed points, and they are comparing the free energies.
Yes, yes, yes. And yeah, then that completely makes sense. Like that fact, as well as what you said regarding your conjecture about the unlinking and stuff, that makes sense now. Okay.
Thanks.
Thank you.
Other questions from students? I don't see any, so I think Leighton had a question.
Also, thank you for the great talk. When you define GII, why do you not define GIJ in an analogous way? Does it need to come undo that?
I haven't got there yet, but I think the answer is yes, one can do it, but I just haven't written it down. So you see, you are the first people to hear about this.
And will one need to do that to check if the metric is flat?
Yes, but I don't expect any problem, but yes, we actually do need to compute the GIJs.
Can you explain what sets of the C and C there in the model? Is that related to the coupling constants or?
That's a good. Okay. Yes. So this you can. The fact that this NC scales as square root of n, this follows from the action. So basically, you have an action which has an oscillatory term because it's a Lorentzian matrix model. And then by the Riemann-Lebesgue lemma, you find that for very large values of n sub c, you would basically, sorry for others. Now what do I want? Okay, so if you look at the partial, so the functional integral is a huge functional integral. For every a, b, you have a separate integral. Mm-hmm. So you fix a minus b, and you look at that particular ray of integration. And then you find that by the Riemann-Lebesgue lemma, if a minus b is bigger than some nc which scales as this, then you get zero contributions. Okay. So this is the way that I find this. So to my knowledge, this has not been analytically justified by people working on matrix theories. Okay. They've observed that.
Numerically.
They've observed that numerically. They didn't even point out this scaling. Okay. They just did simulations with various values of capital N, and then I looked up what is the effect of N sub C, and I realized that this scales like this.
A technical question. When you make A constant for, this constant depends on N, so it's like a strip diagonal, or it's
mm-hmm. Okay. Strip diagonal.
Can you mention something about the main drama feature here is the emergence of three expanding dimensions.
Yep.
How do you go, okay, in the stream case here, we're using it, but what do you mean between this matrix and the...
Okay, so this is a wild conjecture, which I have. And this wild conjecture is that this fundamental strings of string theory are coherent states of the matrix model.
If I
were able to answer your question, I would have written something.
Okay, and no vision, like I said, I don't see the vision.
I don't know. I'm not. My string theory background is too weak, so I need to work on that. Maybe we can discuss it.
There is a question by Lee.
Yes, but very beautiful, Robert, before I say anything. It's not...
Thanks.
It's not...
Actually, you are.
Okay. If fundamental strings are coherent states, aren't also D-brains, since it's a theory of two-dimensional matrices?
Yes.
So you can make the same argument about the specialness of six-dimensional.
No, because you see, it's the low-mass objects that dominate the late-time evolution. And so what will happen is that the brains will, brain plus anti-brain will annihilate before, but the final symmetry breaking pattern will be set by strings annihilating with anti-strings. So that's the argument that we already had in the work with Waffa.
Right. So I'm not going to argue at all. I'm going to contribute something, which is a feature of these theories, which is not well known, which is that they map on to Bohm-type hidden variable theories, so that you can have a quantum mechanics as emergent and not assumed. I can give you the references.
Yeah, I'd appreciate that.
Okay. Great.
You had a zero at some point.
Yeah. And you see, this is one of this state.
Nine matrices?
No, you have 10 matrices total. I started in the BFSS with the XIs, I equals 1 to 9, plus the A0. When I took the high temperature states, then the XIs, their zero modes, become the AIs, the A naught remains.
Okay, so I haven't seen the A0 in the
No, no, the. This A runs from 0 to 9.
Well, that runs from 0 to 9.
From 0 to 9. Because see, I'm taking the A0. The A0 is one of those.
But then, so it's an Euclidean metric? You make a choice?
There is this eta mu nu symbol, which is inbuilt. Okay. So the A0 is distinguished from the other ones.
So it has signature minus plus, 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 plus.
That's put in by hand. Signature is put in by hand.
And so you have to diagnose A0.
No, this is a way, so A0, so I work in terms of.
If you look at A1, it would not have this property of A0.
Okay, see, I could also diagonalize A1 if I wanted to, but, and I would get, at the end of the day, I would get the same physics out of it. But it is easier to get the physics out of it to diagonalize A0. See, essentially, the one way that you can phrase it is that the eigenvalues of A0 become time, the eigenvalues of the AIs become the spatial coordinates. And so just, I'm doing the analysis in the basis in which A0 is diagonal.
Which I'm confused about is that it looks like it's symmetric under A goes to minus A. So I would expect that if any symmetry breaking pattern that happened would sort of occur as you went off in either direction in the time direction.
Remember that you have a functional integral.
Yeah.
So we are doing a functional integral over all values of each element. So each element here has an integration from minus infinity to plus infinity inbuilt. And you see, it's always the squares that contribute. So the fact that the individual matrix elements can be plus, can be negative or positive, that doesn't matter.
I guess I mean that as I go. So when over here, when you're drawing the three get large and six stay small,
yep,
as a function of t, that t is that. Is as I move along the diagonal in this basis.
Yeah.
And I would have thought that it wouldn't matter which way I moved along the diagonal in that basis.
That's true.
So does this thing actually grow up as a function of absolute value of t?
It is symmetric. There are probably solutions. This is a very good question, and I don't know the answer to that completely, but I think that in the IKKD matrix model, you can choose different states. In one state, you will have the following evolution of the spatial matrix, you will have something like this. And you have a different state in which you have this.
Sorry, what's on the x-axis?
Okay, this is the time. This is this variable. And here, this is the size as expressed in terms of...
You're plotting one of the AIs.
Of this. Yeah, one of the AIs.
Comment. I think if you don't assume that the A0s are different from the AIs in the way that would be to a positive definite Hamiltonian, you don't have a stable theory. So hidden behind this is Hamiltonian, is the Hamiltonian analysis. And the Hamiltonian analysis with a 9+1 assumption of the background metric gives a positive definite Hamiltonian. That is, you just get the sum over the I is xi squared, I dot squared.
Other questions? Okay, so if not, let's start again.